Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and joining us next is Louis Menand, a New Yorker writer and professor of English at Harvard. He won the Pulitzer Prize for History back in 2002 for his book, The Metaphysical Club, you may know. Now Menand has written a book called The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. And in it, he argues that the structure of higher education has pretty much stayed the same for over 100 years, while faculty and student populations have changed dramatically and technology has transformed the way that people produce and share knowledge. Menand says reform of the ivory tower is long overdue, but there is strong resistance from the institution itself against change. Louis, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me on the show.
So to start off, what happened in higher education 100 years ago? What established the conditions that you say we're still living with today?
Well, about 100 years ago, in the late 19th century, American higher education was transformed from the model of the college to the model of the research university, in which professors were expected not only to teach but to produce scholarship and research, and that led to the creation of the academic departments. Most of the departments that students major in, field students major in, were created between about 1880 and 1920. And that structure has been pretty consistent ever since the early 20th century, structure of dividing up knowledge by different disciplines and training people to become professors by training them in specific disciplines. So part of what the book discusses are the effects of this system today and the strains that the structure is put under by the demands that we make on it now.
And you say that as professors got academic freedom, I guess, to do their research, they became disconnected from the rest of society. That's the ivory tower effect.
Yeah, which is a good thing and a bad thing. It was a very valuable social contract to make. The principle of academic freedom was first articulated in the U.S. in around 1915 by the philosopher John Dewey and his co-philosopher, Arthur Lovejoy, who created the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors. And the purpose of the AAUP is to protect academic freedom whenever it's been threatened in American higher education. And that's a very important feature of the American system, that academics can feel free to pursue inquiry wherever it may lead. And on the whole, American society has thought that that was a good deal. That is, by protecting professors from political or economic influence and pressure, we get to produce knowledge in the most disinterested way that we can. On the other hand, obviously part of that involves making a kind of firewall between the work of academics and the rest of the culture, and sometimes that can be frustrating on both sides.
Is there a way to preserve academic freedom, keep academia from becoming too market-driven, while ensuring that it is relevant to the broader society?
I think there are a lot of ways of doing it. Yeah, it's just that that professors, I think, are socialized to, particularly in liberal arts institutions, which is really what I'm writing about in the book. There's a whole variety of institutions of higher education that don't really emphasize the liberal arts, but those that do, in those institutions, professors really come to think that there's an opposition between the practical and the true. They think that if there's something practical or useful or instrumental about the work that they're doing or the teaching that they're doing, they're somehow violating the spirit of the liberal arts and sciences, and that they need to remain aloof from those practical interests. I think that's a bit of a superstition, but it inhibits us from thinking about our curricula in liberal arts institutions in a way that will relate what students are learning to the lives that they're going to be leading after they leave college.
Which comes right down to the essence of what a college education is for, I think, because you cite a stat that universities are graduating more and more humanities PhDs, but there are fewer and fewer jobs for them when they finally finish. Now, maybe people who pursue PhDs only think they're going into the job of being a college professor. But a liberal arts education is supposed to, at least in theory, give an understanding of the world before people get, or at the same time that people get any particular professional skills to go out to be, you know, engineers or whatever.
Yeah, this is another thing that we've inherited from the 19th century. In the middle of the 19th century, really up till about 1900, you could go to medical school or law school without having gone to college first. So college was a kind of luxury, because if you wanted to embark on a career in law or medicine or in science, you could go straight into those schools as a teenager. So the creation of the requirement that a bachelor's degree is a prerequisite for a professional school is one of the great achievements of 19th century higher education. But part of that deal was that professional training, practical training, would only take place when you got to graduate school, to professional school, and that college would be about knowledge for its own sake, and hence the liberal arts and sciences, which is extremely important, I think everyone agrees, for cultivation of values and faculties that are not associated with simply earning a living and doing well in the world, and that's a very valuable thing. But it's also the case that students do want to learn things that are going to be relevant to their future careers. Most students are not going to become academics, and the normal structure of undergraduate instruction trains people in disciplines as though they were going to go on to become professors in those disciplines. Usually they don't. Even at a place like Harvard, where undergraduates are trained at what we think of anyway as the cutting edges of our disciplines, less than 10% of our graduates go on to get PhDs. 60% of our college graduates at Harvard go to business school, law school, and medical school.
Jim in the Bronx is a college professor who has a question for you. And if you're just tuning in, our guest is Louis Menand, the New Yorker writer, who has a book called Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. Hi, Jim. You're on WNYC.
Hi. I have to disagree strongly with what two things the professor has said. First of all, it's not the ivory tower effect that makes professors isolated from the world. It's the pressure to publish or perish. That if you don't turn out books, articles, and other research on a regular basis, you don't get tenured, you don't get promoted after tenure, and that's what drives increasingly arcane, narrow, and specialized research, not the ivory tower effect. Secondly, I also strongly disagree with his comments on the curriculum. I work at the City University system, and what we have to struggle against is essentially a student body, because of their backgrounds, who have a kind of trade school mentality about higher education. They're there to get a specialized skill, often very narrow, and often not at all interested in anything beyond what will get them a job. That may be an issue at Harvard or Yale. It is not an issue at a public university anywhere in the country, I think. So I strongly disagree with his comments, and I'd like to hear his response.
Those are two excellent points. On the first point, yes, it's also true that I didn't invoke the ivory tower, Brian did, but it's also true that the pressure to publish has grown greater and greater over the last 40 or 50 years, and that does tend, I think, to produce the kind of specialized scholarship which has a smaller and smaller audience, and that is part of how the system has evolved since the 1960s, so that's an excellent point. On your second point, also well taken, I actually taught at CUNY for 15 years before I came to Harvard, and they're very different institutions, they have very different constituencies, the demands are, as you put it, the demands are rather the reverse at a place like City University of New York, where students do have an overly utilitarian view of what the college education ought to be, and the system in those places has to resist that. It's a complicated picture. All I'm trying to do in the book and in talking about these issues is to try to shed some historical light on why the system has evolved in the way that it has, because that will help us when we try to think about ways that we want to reform it. There are lots of things that people would like to see happen in higher education. It's often puzzling why those things are so hard to make happen.
And Jim, thank you for your call. You're down on the trend toward interdisciplinary work at the college level, which is something that everybody else seems to think is cutting edge. You know, we're not supposed to work in quote-unquote silos anymore, but we're supposed to work across disciplines. This is true in the professional world, too. But what's wrong with interdisciplinary study?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the idea of transcending disciplinarity, which is what's usually said when you ask people why they favor interdisciplinarity. But the form that interdisciplinarity usually takes is to get a professor from one department together in a classroom with a professor from another department and to teach a subject from two perspectives. But if you think about it, that just ratifies disciplinarity, because what it does is suggest that the disciplines are the sum total of all possible perspectives on whatever subject it is. And what I think people really want to have happen is to get outside the box altogether of disciplinary boundaries. And that's a difficult, frustrating thing to do. And part of the reason is we don't train people to be interdisciplinary. We wait until they've got their credential, they've got their PhD, they've written their dissertation, they've got their jobs, and then we ask them to do interdisciplinary work without ever having given them training to think about things in that way. So that really doesn't produce the kind of result that we want. So my only point about interdisciplinarity, apart from the point that it just does tend to ratify the disciplines, in effect, is that interdisciplinarity, if we really want it, has to begin at home. It has to begin in the way that we teach people, in the way we train people, if we want to have it really be effective in the world of scholarship.
So before you go, what's the resistance? In your subtitle, it's reform and resistance in the American university. Resistance to what and for what?
The system resists. It's not that people have bad intentions, it's that the system resists. So I'll give you one quick example. I think most people agree that the time it takes to get a PhD in the humanities now is really disproportionately long. It takes a median time of 9 years to get a PhD in the humanities. There's all kinds of reasons why the system has produce this result. It's not because anybody cynically sat there and thought we want to keep people in school longer. It's not that students don't want to graduate more quickly. It's not that we want students to remain as students for so long. It's just that the system has produced this result. And it's something that we want to change, but in order to change it, we need to understand why we have this overproduction of PhDs and this incredibly long time to degree. That's true of many other areas like interdisciplinarity. We just need to think about historically the structure of universities in order to understand why we face problems today. The resistance doesn't come from people. It comes from a structure that people inhabit and have to learn how to maneuver inside of.
The New Yorker writer Louis Menand, now the author of The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thank you, Brian.
And this is a serious, complex issue, but let's end it on a lighter note. Here's a song by a liberal arts major at Purdue, sung to potential employers on why she'd be a great hire.
Well, I heard that you were hiring, and you're wondering what skills that I can bring. I studied liberal arts at Purdue. Let me tell you everything I can do for you. I'm flexible and I adapt to change, because the classes I took covered such a wide range. I communicate well, both verbally and written, and my speaking skills will have you smitten. La, 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 liberal arts is the way. La, 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 and you should hire me today, because I'm a people person and groups I work well. Doesn't take me long to shed my shell. Thinking out of the